Welcome to Kjellander and Björk. And yeah, this is English. We usually do Swedish episodes, but it makes sense, I promise. We're talking to Professor Amy Lutfi from Örebro University today, and we're really thrilled to have her on our show. And so talking to Amy, we really wanted her to have the full rich toolbox of words that a native language provides, even though she do fine in Swedish. The conversation today is about human-robot interaction and all the cool concepts connected to this field. And the conversation takes us through quite a lot, actually. Electronic gnosis, the importance of language, sensing and perception, future hunts for knowledge, education, quite a lot of education in a broad sense, and of course the state of things in AI. I would also like to mention that this episode is sponsored by Dun & Bradstreet, a leading European data and analytics company. Dun & Bradstreet enables companies to make smarter decisions by pioneering smart data. And together with you who listens to us, they want to explore the data-driven society. What can AI, machine learning, and automation really do for our society, for our companies, and for us, humans? If this is the first time you've heard of Amy Lutfi, be sure to Google her and you'll find remarkable achievements and findings connected to her work. Once you're at it, Google WASP as well. It's Wallenberg Autonomous Sensor System Program. So we give you human-robot interaction and Professor Amy Lutfi.
Amy, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
We're so glad to have you here.
Yeah. It's great to be here.
How's your morning been?
My morning so far has been good, but it's been very snowy this morning.
Yeah.
We've had a little bit of bad weather, but otherwise it's fine.
So you're in Örebro, right?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Near Hjälmaren.
Exactly, yeah. Most people don't think of Örebro as being one of these cities with a lake, but
yeah.
Yeah. But it has a lake, and a big one. Sweden is known for its big lakes. Yeah.
Really a cozy town, around, I think, 200,000 inhabitants?
Yeah, a little bit less. I think maybe 140 or so.
Right.
Yeah, but it's a very quaint, it's a very beautiful city, and it's a very diverse city. I think that's one of the reasons why I like it so much. So it doesn't have any, like, dominant industry, it doesn't have a dominant sector, but they're all there. You know, you have everything from mining, IT, a lot of culture, a lot of music, a lot of sports. So there's something for everyone. So I really enjoy being in this city.
Usually you could peg someone from Örebro by their dialect. There's something going on with some tiny whininess in the dialect. But I'm doing a leap here, Amy.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you're not from Örebro.
I am not from Örebro, no. I am from Canada, but I do speak Swedish.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I can't hear it. Maybe that's one of the reasons why I like being here so much. So I can hear certain types of dialects, like from the far south, from the far north. And I've been told that there's a bit of a whine in the Örebro dialect, but I don't pick it up myself.
That's kind of... That's the advanced level of language, I imagine, that when you kind of understand, then you can hear subtleties and nuances of a language.
Yeah.
So and that is just the tiny whine from Örebro. That's the, like, ninja level of language.
And maybe that's the next field of research, picking up an AI, picking up the dialects, if it's not already in use.
Yeah, it could be.
Could you onboard us a bit, the listeners? Who are you, Amy?
Right, so I'm a researcher, a professor in an area called information technology. And my interest is on understanding how we can interpret data that comes from sensors. So you have a lot of sensor information, and not just from cameras, but also other types of sensors that could pick up sound, that can pick up smell, you know, you name it. And I'm really interested in how you interpret that sensor data using different kinds of methods and techniques. And that's where the AI comes in. And we'll probably talk a lot about that in the next hour or so. And I'm interested in this interpretation because I want to make sure that these kinds of sensors, whether they be kind of spread out in your environment or whether they are all collected on one and the same machine, like a robot, that these sensors can somehow interact in a good way with people. And what I mean by that is that it would be very fun if, for example, we can use sensors to tell us about the world in a way that maybe we don't perceive it, right? And in enrich our understanding of the world around us. Or it would be very fun to use these sensors to give a machine, like a robot, the ability to also make really good decisions and then in turn help us as humans. So I would say, if I had to say very shortly what I'm interested in, it is machine perception and interaction.
And I saw you wrote your doctoral thesis on an electronic nose.
Yeah, so I came to Sweden in 1999, and I came here as an exchange student. I was doing my my engineering degree. And when I came to Sweden, I was a little bit sort of late in finding a placement where I wanted to do my exchange, just because I'm a procrastinator. So I picked at the last moment where I wanted to do my placement. And unfortunately, by being late, all these placements all over Europe were taken. Spain was completely fully booked, and Portugal and France. But there were a lot of places left in a little town called Örebro in Sweden. So kind of being my last choice, I sort of said, okay, I can go to Örebro. And when I came here, there was a group, a research group being built up around AI. That group was really international. And of course, being in Sweden as an international student, I needed to take courses in English. And one of the courses that were being offered that I could take was a course in AI. And it was given by this this very little Italian woman who introduced all of these Swedes and some international students to the field of AI. And she asked me if I would be interested in later doing a PhD, and I accepted the offer. And then my thesis was, the topic we discussed together was very much about whether or not you can endow, so you can give robots the ability to perceive odors. So I basically used what we call gas sensors that could perceive kind of a rich range of of odors. I put these gas sensors onto robots and tried to make sense out of all of that information and make the robots do something fun.
So this digital nose thing is so interesting, I think, and what it can mean in practice and maybe in the this post-pandemic period. Can it help people like recover their sense of smell, or what's the potential of the electronic nose?
Yeah, maybe what it could do is give an interpretation of the odors around it. And one of the things that I discovered, you know, very early on in my doctoral thesis was that, you know, these sensors are a bit finicky in the sense that you get really kind of messy signals coming out of these sensors. And if you look at the signals with the human eye, you can't see the difference really between different types of odors. You could smell the scent of a rose, or you can smell a cup of wine, and the signals look more or less the same. And that's when we realized we needed, you know, some of that AI to help us understand the signals. But one of the things that I became very fascinated on was, how do we humans talk about odors? And this actually, I think, opened up my curiosity about not just looking only at technology, but looking at humans and using our human way, our human intelligence, as an inspiration to create artificial intelligence. And when I looked a little bit more about how humans interpret and cope with odors, you see how important language is, right? And if you think about Vision, we break down into RGB, you know, red, green, blue. We can compose a color out of numbers. But you can't do that so easily with odors. And odors are very attached to emotion. They're attached to your memories. And I realized if I wanted to get my robot to talk about odors, it has to talk about odors using kind of a similar language. So it had to use words. And this started really to be, I think, the seeds of my own research into AI, which is, you know, how do we give language to what we perceive and what we sense? And I started out with odors, and that was what my thesis was about. But then as I started to kind of, after my PhD, I started to look at objects and how we talk about the world and how we connect the real world to language. So I'm not sure our electronic noses could help anyone who is suffering from, you know, sort of the effects of having COVID-19. But I do think there are ways in which the technology can be complementary to our own. Maybe pick up what we don't pick up and let us know about it. And there is a power, I think. For AI.
Really interesting. I need to, I think there are three lanes we can do from this. There's how to sort odors, how to set language for odors, and what technology should do for humans. There's like three paths. I need to go into odors just for a while.
Sure.
I think it's this just sparked my curiosity. Now, when you got talking, Amy, is there a standardized way of sorting odors? Is there a framework, a model? Is there something?
Well, there are domain-specific ways, which means that if you're in the wine industry, you tend to have a certain vocabulary. If you're in kind of another food stuff, you'll have another set of words that you use.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you try and do, especially if you want to maintain a quality, is that you really have to train humans very well, right? You have to train them on how to use that vocabulary depending on what they sense and make sure that the nose or the instrument that they have is very good. And then based on that, you can try and calibrate everyone to each other.
Yeah.
But there is no, let's say, well sort of understood or well used nomenclature for everybody.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge. And like I said, also odors if you look at in our culture, they have been talked about in very, very special ways. I think Shakespeare said, a rose by any other name would smell just as sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to speak very poetically about odors, and that makes it even more challenging.
So this is so much fun. So this should, from a scientific perspective, it's actually I'm a bit shocked that we haven't worked towards this big sensory system more. That is it too complex to get that type of generic information model, which I'm aiming for here? Is it too complex to get our heads around it?
Well, I think there's just so much that we still don't understand about how odors work, in particularly how we process odors in our brain and also in our. We have something called the olfactory bulb, where where we also get a lot of information about odors. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're still not able to create that perfect sensor.
Yeah.
And I mean, it really is fascinating because olfaction, so the sense of smell, is one of our oldest senses.
Yeah.
And it's also a sense that when we when we don't have such a good sense of olfaction, we rely on other animals to help us. So we have dogs, for example, that are really, we train them and we use their instrument. So I think until we get a better understanding of olfaction, it's going to be hard for us to create the kind of perfect electronic nose.
So, Amy, we would like to move into like a state of things, AI, where we are right now. I noticed that it's, I think in May, it's been 25 years since Garry Kasparov played the famous game against the IBM supercomputer Deep Blue. That was like the big the showdown between humans and then silicon, and after Garry resigned the game, I think it was less than an hour, he turned to the audience and he said the machine played like a god. And that was 25 years ago, and for me and for humanity it was like the great awakening of the possibilities of AI. And now we're talking about AI and odor. And will there be like a showdown between AI and a dog for smell in 2022? Or where are we right now when it comes to AI?
All right. Well, a showdown, I'm not such a big fan of showdowns, although there are a number of these challenges set up. For example, there's a challenge, I believe, that robots should play football, so soccer. Mm-hmm. Better than humans by, I think it's like 2050 or something like that. And I'm still not fully convinced that we should go for those things. But it's nice. It's a nice way to motivate researchers to kind of working on a common goal. Mm-hmm. In terms of the state of things, so AI is actually a much older than the Kasparov kind of competition. And it was really kind of, I think, talked about, maybe not using those terms, for almost 100 years, where you have, you know, some of the first computer scientists, or what we consider computer scientists, talking about how you can make machines that not only can compute, but can sort of systematically figure out what kind of instructions they should follow in order to solve a task. And that's what you heard from people like Ada Lovelace, who was, I think, one of the pioneers of computer science. She really did, I think, sort of set the tone for computer science. You have people like Alan Turing, of course, as also, I think, one of the grandfathers of AI. And then things started to pick up in the 50s, 50s and 60s. Where, strangely enough, the vision was never AI on its own, but it was always AI in a body, right?
Yeah.
It was robots. Robots were always kind of the view of AI. You had the machine that had a embodiment or embodiment and could do something, and it was intelligent. And that kind of went on until, I would say, about the 70s, when people started to become a bit disillusioned and think, this isn't going to work. We don't need machines to be smart. Machines just need to automate. And all of this AI thinking, well, we just don't have computers for it.
No.
And so at some point, you could almost call this kind of the divorce between AI and robotics. And people, I think, mainly thought, well, the future is in robotics. You know, the future is in these automated machines that, without any intelligence, move from point A to point B, high precision, high speed. But in the background, the computer scientists were working away in creating, you know, good computers. And what we saw in the 90s was kind of the rebound of the AI researchers without robots. We saw AI manage just fine by, you know, being purely software based. And the game of chess was a wonderful sort of example of how AI could handle a computationally difficult challenge. The funny thing is, if you look at the videos with Kasparov, Kasparov is actually sitting across the table from a human. And yeah. what is the human doing, right? It's a guy who is basically looking at a screen, seeing where the computer says to put the next piece, and he has to actually move the piece, representing what the what the machine wants.
I think that was the engineer from IBM.
Exactly.
I think, yeah.
And I think that it was very telling because it showed you how all of a sudden AI kind of surpassed the development of robotics. And it's been making a lot of strides at the moment, you know. We went from sort of solving very complicated searching problems, and that's what chess is. You have to search for the best solution, to developing machines that can learn, or developing algorithms that enable you to learn from data.
Yeah.
And where are we now? I think we are still very much pushing what is possible to do with AI, but I also think that there is a reunion happening between our AI and robotics, you know, where we're seeing that we can actually put this AI back into the machine and get smarter machines like autonomous vehicles or different types of service robots, mining vehicles, like all of these kinds of robots now that can benefit from a little bit more AI. So that the divorced couple are now reuniting. And I think it can be quite exciting what will happen.
One thing I think that that we discovered after this famous chess game is also that the world doesn't resemble chess in any way. It's so complex. And I saw you, I think it was a keynote that you had, you defined a robot, I think, in its how it works outside its own body, a robot that can move around. Can you take us through that interesting definition?
Sure. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of discussions about what robots are, right?
Yeah.
And normally we say that, well, robots should have sensors, so it should be able to perceive its environment. It should have actuators, so it should be able to act and affect its environment. It should have a little bit of software that puts those two things together. So based on what it perceives, it can make a decision. And then comes the question, well, if that's what a robot is, why do I, for example, look at my vacuum cleaner as a robot, but I don't necessarily look at my dishwasher as a robot? Or even if you go to, for example, if you go to the shopping center, you know, you have automatic doors. You don't think, wow, what an advanced robot opening the doors, right? And there comes that ingredient that you talked about, which is the workspace, in the sense that we often view that robots work outside of their body.
Yes.
So their body themselves is a tool in which they infect their environment. And that's usually a component that I think is important to be able to look at a machine and really say, well, that's a robot, as opposed to that's just an intelligent machine.
So this it opens up so many potential lanes to discuss. But given the state of things, how do you see that the ones not invested in your field understands potential and what type of feelings do you see in people when you talk about your work and when you show them stuff?
Yeah, it's very mixed. Fear, of course, is one of them. There's fear and concern. There's another feeling that I encounter a lot, which is, well, what's the point?
Yeah.
I've worked, for example, a lot in the area of domestic robots, so having robots in your home, and we worked and looked a lot at applications where these kinds of systems could help people maybe stay at home longer. And it was often in interactions, particularly with elderly, that they could say, well, what's the point? I don't need that.
Yeah.
You know? and really having a kind of view of machines are machines and they should be useful. And if they're not useful, they shouldn't exist. And then there's this other sentiment I've encountered many, many times, and I've been asked countless of times, which is, what happens if they start to take over?
Right. Mm. Yeah.
Right.
A standard kind of question.
It's a standard question. You know, I anticipated it almost every talk I give.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there is that third emotion, which is excitement. And those kinds of feelings tend to come from people who really have a problem that they need help with. And they really see the possibilities that finally I'll be able to do this, or finally this will help me in my everyday. And it really comes from across the board. I mean, so many diverse people can see the potential. Yeah. Of the technology.
Andreas and I have been talking a lot about AI and robots and future concepts in general. And one idea that we think is fun is when we have, so we have probably the fastest movements of norm development, probably the fastest ever. So we're toying with this idea that the norm will probably hit robots and sensory things that communicate, whether or not they should be included in like human level of rights and restrictions and responsibilities anything that is human like, and that will probably hit us somewhere the coming 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Is that, what do you see? That's like a fun idea to toy with. But could it be something like that?
I think you're very optimistic.
Yeah.
I think, in the next 50 years, I wouldn't say that we will have sort of a charter sort of being able to express and regulate the rights of machines. Hmm. Simply because I don't think we will be at the point where we will see a sort of level of, if you want to call it intelligence or free will, in these kinds of machines. No. But I do think we are going to understand a little bit more the effect of robots, but also other types of AI on us. And here is a very interesting discussion about how, I mean, when it comes to AI, we of course see this very much so in social media and how algorithms impact our everyday life. But also when you start putting AI into a machine like a robot, I think there are some risks that we may fall into. I don't know if you guys have ever looked at these videos from Boston Dynamics.
Yeah, definitely. That's the one I think of. The dog and someone kicking the dog.
Exactly.
For that. Yeah.
Exactly. So what happens to us depending on how we treat machines? Yeah. I think that's a very interesting question. And I think that's definitely worth taking up, certainly in the next decade or so, because it does have an impact.
Yeah, and that's, I think, this AI acceptance thing. I was thinking regarding the, I was going to ask a question about AI panic. You know, there's been a lot of talk, AI taking over, robots taking over our jobs, etc. I would say for me right now, we have this geopolitical tension. I would rather say I'm more scared of AI warfare. And AI used, we see countries like galloping for this technology to be used in wars. I think that's the really scary part, I would say.
Yeah. And I agree. I think there is the biggest risk at the moment. And we are in a bit of an information warfare, right? And everything is compounded by digitalization. And AI is a very interesting tool/weapon, depending on how you use it. So I fully agree with you on that.
Definitely. And going back to Örebro and to the university, what do you see is the role of the university in in this regard, in AI acceptance and raising competence in this important question?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that, because I think this is where, I mean, everything kind of boils down to knowledge. Mm. And it doesn't mean that because we have the knowledge, we're going to avoid or circumvent that people misuse the technology, maybe even on the contrary. But the point is that at least the knowledge gives us an awareness and yeah. we can confront the problem with our eyes wide open.
Right.
And I think one of the things that the universities should do, and I think that we're trying to do, but more certainly can be done, is how do we get that knowledge about AI into other disciplines?
Yes. And
this is going back to, I think, a problem that we have, that we tend to separate the natural sciences from the humanities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in Sweden, you do that also at a very early age. You know, you make these kind of really big decisions about, you know, what kind of knowledge you should get. And I think really we all need a bit of both.
Yeah.
And that's why I love robotics, because it's one of the fields where you need everything, you know.
Well, I think you tie it together brilliantly. By saying that, because when we started this conversation, we talked about orders and the complexity of sorting them, and you went quite fast into languages. So there's the discipline crossover in some sense, I guess. And when we talk with business leaders and thinkers and creators on this podcast, pretty much every conversation we end up with some sort of cross-functional team as a solution to the complexity that we're heading into. So I think that's what I'm hearing for you as well. Also, I just want to throw in a brilliant quote from you, probably not saying it exactly the right way here, but you've said, if you treat digitalization as a programming in school, it's like treating sexual education only as anatomy. So yeah. I think that kind of puts it on a spike as yeah. well. It's too yeah, narrow. Yeah. Mm.
It is, yeah. And we all need sort of tools to navigate in a very yeah. complex world, right? So we need to nuance things a little bit more. Yeah, so in a sense, we're kind of almost needing, I would say, like an educational revolution.
Yeah. Mm. But
where we 100%. Change schooling so that it really reflects education, you know, or where we really talk about what knowledge you need.
Because that is, if we jump into to what one might be scared of looking at the field of AI, all the possibilities, is that pretty much whenever we've discovered stuff as humans, we've incrementally built our knowledge. And there is something in AI that is, putting the cat out of the box problem. I don't know if I'm phrasing it the right way, but there's some power in AI that might be hard for the world to take if we don't have the right approach to knowledge and to how we should develop this field. Do you get anything from?
I do. I think what I would say is that AI is challenging our systems.
Yeah.
And a lot of the systems we have today, whether it's the healthcare, whether it's education, has been built really to cope with what happened after the Second World War.
Yeah.
And it's been built to cope with industrialization and an industrialized nation where we are working laborers, all of us, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Our purpose is to be educated so that we can come out onto kind of the working field and all of a sudden contribute back to society and find yeah. meaning in our labor. And what happened probably around the time Kasparov won his match, of course, mm-hmm. was that we got this information age coming and this digitalization age.
Yes.
And that on its own, I don't think would have broken everything. But combining it now with an automation that comes from AI, The fact that AI can handle all of this information in an automated way.
Yeah.
I think it's all of a sudden sort of putting us into a bit of a crisis, but it's a system crisis. I don't believe it's a humanity crisis. It's a system crisis where the way we organize work, the way we organize education, the way we organize a lot of the things in society, healthcare, for example, are being sort of not challenged, but maybe there are new windows of opportunity popping up, and we're not sure how to handle it. We're not sure how to marry that with our traditional views of industry and our traditional views of business models and all of that. So I think it's exciting, but I can also understand why people think it's also a bit scary.
but I think that's the most fascinating part about technology and robotics, the things that we learn about ourselves, about being human, because all these systems were designed by humans from the basis of what we know right now. This should be the best way to organize work, or this should be the best way to organize things. So I think what we learn about our minds, that's so exciting, and that's also why I was so glad when I saw the last report that you published. I think it was called "Do You Feel Safe with Your Robot?" where you talked about factors influencing perceived safety in human-robot interaction. So. First, why is this field why is this important, this robot acceptance thing?
Yeah, no, it is. It's something that we saw, and in particular, I saw over the course of many, many years of doing research on actually making the technical solutions.
Mm. Yes,
that there was these strange things happening in interaction. And one of the things that I perceived very early on during my research was that sometimes the stupidest of robots would get the nicest names, you know, that people would be always calling their robots, like the lawnmower robots. Mm. For me, a lawnmower robot is really not that much of an autonomous machine. It's very guided by the cable that you put right in the lawn. But they would really look at that robot and they would give it a name. They would talk about it in very sort of living terms, anthropomorphic terms, but also almost like a pet. And I always found this to be very interesting. And I have seen it many, many times throughout my career. And when we started to look at domestic robots, or robots in your home, we thought, well, maybe we should have a PhD just dedicated on, you know, what do you need to feel like this robot is some entity that you can rely on, that you can trust? And that was the result of from one of my PhD students who has been looking at this for the past few years and has come up with a number of factors which I think are not in any way surprising, but still what is interesting is how she derived those factors.
Yes.
And the factors that influence whether or not you feel safe with a robot is whether you can trust it in the sense that it is predictable, whether it's reliable, whether or not it sort of respects, let's say, things like personal distance and these kinds of factors. And she discovered, you know, these factors by using a combination of two things. On one hand, she asked people. So she did a lot of experiments with humans and robots and asked them, do you trust the robot? How do you feel with the robot? But on the other hand, and this is the part that I think is interesting, she measured their reactions. She looked at their facial expressions. She looked at how they reacted when the robot would come close to them. And she tried to see, is there any correlation between what people say and what people do? And based on that, getting some factors.
One quick jab. Did she use some sort of AI emotion perceivement technology to, or
oh, yes.
It? Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Of course, yeah.
Of course, yeah.
I was also interested in there in the difference between like humanoids and androids. because Mats and I, we had the opportunity to actually, we had an interview with this Sofia the robot when she visited Sweden. So, and that was a bit awkward.
Yeah, it was.
And we talk about, we have this term, uncanny valley that you talk about in your industry when the robot is too human-like, it freaks us out. And I would freak out if my electronic lawnmower looked like a relative. Did she look at this as well in this study?
Not in this study, but I've looked at it in previous studies.
Okay.
And I've also looked at cross-cultural analysis.
Yeah.
So how do Swedes, for example, react versus Italians and when it comes to robots and how robots should behave and how robots should appear. And one of the things we saw was that both the Swedish and the Italian groups want their machines to look like machines. And this actually is something that's a little bit different from other cultures like the Japanese, where there is another view about robots. And this goes all the way back to you know, how literature and pop culture also has been portraying machines. In Europe and in Western civilizations, we tend to see machines kind of rising up against us and harming us, kind of the Frankenstein, Terminator 2, that kind of view. Whereas in Japanese culture, often the machines are victims of human cruelty.
Yeah.
Like Ghost in the Shell, for example, Astro Boy. These are all examples where, you know, the machine really is something good. It understands what's good for us. But the humans are so cruel that we somehow, you know, sabotage things for ourselves. So I think there's very deep, deep cultural sentiments around that. And one of the things that we've tried to do is work with these very multidisciplinary teams, because we don't sit on all that knowledge ourselves. We need to somehow bring in different groups. And I think this is, the fun part about being a researcher. So right now, with my PhD student who wrote that article, we're also working with people who are specialized in gender studies and understanding how gender and the way we kind of sometimes impose a gender onto a robot. How does that impact how we see what that robot can or cannot do?
That should be really, really interesting. I'm just creating an information model in my head as I speak now. I tend to do that. And it should be really fun to see if we could get some sort of segmentation, various segmentations on how we perceive technology and how we perceive robots in particular, just to see if there are some commonalities between, like, depending on culture, as you just said, or gender, or perhaps other aspects of big concepts and aspects of being a human, where these links, because that will be, I would guess that's really useful in the coming years, just getting that type of understanding, because then we can, my bad word to it, go to market.
It's
going to be of use, because if we don't perceive this as valuable, and if you're scared of it, you're not going to use it, and it can't be valuable within any field we want to use it. So
that's right. Yeah.
So I'm going to click when that report comes. I'm going to click.
All right.
Click and read and understand.
Good.
So.
Yeah, but I think one of the things about being again doing research in a field that's so wide and broad like AI and bringing in also robotics is it's a bit like that Black Mirror, you know, that Black Mirror effect. If you're alone in a room and it's dark outside and you see your own reflection, that's kind of what it does. I mean, I agree with you, Mats. Like, you know, you maybe could make better machines and maybe sell more machines. But I think from my perspective, it's just kind of to uncover a little bit about what humanity is.
Yeah.
What does it mean to be human? And I think that investigation in itself, I hope, can guide us to a better future.
So I think you put it a bit better than I did. I think we're on to one way that Andreas and I, we usually talk about it in, is that this shift that we're in, that I think that you referenced as well, we're born, certainly we three are born in an industrial way, in an industrial mindset, and almost like we look at and perceive the world as a machine, and we're entering something new, and it puts pressure on the systems, it creates tensions, and we need to rediscover a lot of things that we've taken for granted before. And I think with these studies that you're doing now and your team, they are actually trying to discover, rediscover humanity in the age of robots and AI and how information is going to work for us going forward. So I guess that's really useful. When you talk about this in your forums, how do the rest perceive this? Do they see it's as useful? What type of reactions do you get from these reports?
It's interesting because the forums that I'm in, at least where we publish our studies, they are very, very technical.
Yeah.
Actually, it's very seldom. It's usually when I speak, more to a popular setting, that I get the opportunity to be a bit more philosophical.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it really is about, what kind of statistical tests that you've been using, what kind of algorithms do you use. So it's extremely sort of technical from that perspective. But I think Sweden is, I enjoy sort of the culture in Sweden of really talking and debating about things and stepping back and trying to reflect. I think it's a really nice kind of way of balancing out both the technical and, as I mentioned before, the other sides that are just as important, if not more.
And one more there on the more philosophical side is, I think there also been a discussion about the world becoming more robot friendly. We're building more robot friendly environments, and in the end, I think someone said that it will be almost like living in a washing machine. Do you think that we also need to build this dynamic, complex environments where only us humans can be in, where it's more impossible for robots to work?
Wow, that's a very good question. I've never really thought of that before, like how we should build environments and for whom or for what. I think we should build environments that allow for ecosystems to exist without one species dominating over the other. I think we've learned that is getting us into a lot of trouble. So maybe not for robots, maybe not for humans, but maybe make sure that our planet is healthy. I think that's kind of the core of where we need to be.
Definitely.
So this technology, all your studies and all the other struggles in this field will probably end up in that technology will really, really enhance humans. Enhance whatever endeavors we're heading into, hopefully something sustainable. So how do you think that this can affect us going forward? Could we get like 5 more senses, and could we like have a exponential development of our IQ, and what could happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think you put you hit the nail on the head, because I think after we go through this big AI explosion that we're going through at the moment, and we might get some more intelligent machines, I do think human augmentation is kind of the next thing. And I'm talking about maybe 40, 50 years ahead, maybe even longer. Mm. I think there are some things that we can do with human augmentation that isn't about creating just a superhuman, but just to give humans good quality of life.
Yeah.
And we have it to some extent today. If I look at a human being today, we are a little bit, sort of this bionic machine. We put lenses into our eyes.
Yes.
Some of us have titanium in our hips and our knees, And they don't necessarily give us any superpower, but they allow us to cope. Mm. And I'm thinking maybe that will be the first step, is perhaps we will give abilities to those who currently don't have those abilities, a means to be mobile, a means to maintain your cognition without necessarily losing it. These kinds of capabilities, I think, would be a good starting point.
So what would be a cool superpower, do you think?
Cool superpower.
A laser eyes or something like that.
Oh, what a question. A cool superpower. Something beyond what we are able to do today.
The nose of a dog, perhaps. Yeah.
Maybe, yes. Yeah, maybe better senses. No, I don't know. I think I have to think about that one for a bit.
But it's a fun thought to have. What if we are to go into just extended cognition? If you like, toy with that concept. That we will probably. I mean, we're curious. Humans are curious, so we will head into that field. I guess whenever technology takes leaps, it starts with getting stuff even. So healthcare, for instance, is almost always the field where we start, so we could help people extend and get the norm life expectancy. But after that, the innovation starts and we get the next level of stuff. Just looking at how beauty has taken over what healthcare used for 30 years ago. So there's gonna be some sort of push here, and it's fun and hard to understand where it's gonna go, because it's norms follows as well. So the role of AI in that's the question, and you don't need to answer, but that's the one we want. We'll think about as well. Here,
yeah.
Have you had any setups or discussions about it? And is that something that you guys could research? How do you research that?
Yeah, I think we've had a lot of coffee room discussions, right?
Yeah.
But actually, researching into the future, I think is not quite my field of study. Rather, it is more. All right, how do we build algorithms so that they can be mathematically proven to be sound? And how can we demonstrate that this algorithm can compute things in real time, for example? Those are the kinds of questions we do. I mean, maybe I can start to feel it's a little bit boring when I'm talking to you guys as opposed to these larger questions. But I think, as you said, there are always these consequences that you can't anticipate.
Yeah.
And the question is, should we be able to anticipate everything? Should we sit here today and say this is exactly what's going to happen in the next 30 years? And somehow I believe that the answer to that is no. I think at some point, a little bit of the future has to be a bit of a black box. Mm. And then we can see what will happen. But if I can go back, I know the answer to the superpower question.
Yeah, cool.
What superpower I would like. And I think that is a combined collective intelligence / empathy.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, like right now, we Google everything, right? And imagine if we can get access to that. You remember in the film The Matrix when he kind of opens his eyes and says, "I know Kung Fu." You know, if you can do that, but also combine it also with a sense of empathy, so you can also get an understanding of where your fellow human reasons and thinks, because I think we're missing a little bit of that today.
That would be so valuable. And I also have an idea of what persons to install this AI on first.
Okay.
So, but let's spare the details. And my mind goes off. I was thinking about already thinking about the next Olympics, 2026, 2030. This augmented humans. Maybe finally Sweden will take more gold medals than Norway.
Yeah. I think I just ordered a kind of a report on what's human judgment and how it's everything's going to be in like 40 years. And you don't need to do that study now. But I have one more that I would like. Having your mind and your team meet, and I don't know the English word,
ethnologists. Yeah.
What could happen if you guys meet? How could you enrich each other in how, because ethnologists they perceive the world in such a fantastic way, I think.
Right.
So what could happen if you discuss the future and the possibilities of AI and robots from an ethnologist framework?
I think maybe we're getting full circle, because I think we have to go back to what we started talking about, which is language. Mm. I think the first thing we would have to do is spend a lot of time learning each other's language.
Yes.
And again, that kind of goes back to what we were also talking about, education, and that things have been a little bit too much siloed. So when I say one word, I mean one thing, just like my electronic nose once did. And then when I speak to someone from a completely different discipline, they may use the same words but mean different things.
Yeah.
And finding a way to realize how we use language so that we can gain some kind of common semantic about things. I think once we do that, then we would have a lot of fun together, for sure. We could probably find a lot of interesting questions.
Yeah. Great answer. Mm.
So, Amy, before we let you off the hook, we have one more question that we ask all our guests this season. And we figure that this decade will be filled with innovation, digitization, various forms of sustainability and climate work. But we are curious about what more qualities that may become important in the coming years. Now, you've already talked about qualities here, but what characteristic do you think is important to consider in this decade?
So I would say education. And I don't mean schooling. Mm. I really mean, how do we find places to educate one another, and to keep doing it lifelong. So I think that's going to be really important, and making sure that what has been sort of what our previous generations know can really go into the next generation. So transgenerational education. Mm. I think this is really crucial for moving forward.
Oh, that's so great. I think it was the author Warren Berger who said, "Let's make every day more like a TED conference."
Mm.
So I really love that quote. So,
yeah.
And education. Mats, what do you say?
Yeah, I totally agree. I have like 400 reactions I want to do in it, but I agree, and I think you actually kind of sums it up in an elegant way, because that is, from my way of seeing it, what took place when we sat around fireplaces and as nomads 100,000 years ago. Just that kind of interaction between generations and had a way of getting that moving on. So back to basics in that sense.
Yeah, back to basics in a digital age.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah.
Nice.
from nomads to AI to nomads again.
Yes.
Amy, it's been so nice talking to you, and we will follow your work definitely, and see all these interesting projects that you have that we haven't had the chance to discuss today, but we follow. So thank you very much.
It was great speaking with you both. Thank you.
It's been a treat. And take care.
Thanks for listening to Amy, Andreas, and me, Mats. Did this spark your curiosity? Did this raise new questions for you? It certainly did for us. We totally feel that we want to have more conversation about the intersection between humanity and robots, since that knowledge field will probably become really important the coming years. If you want to listen into more about robots and AI, don't miss our conversation in Swedish with Danica Kragic from October 2018. It's called 0408 Danica Kragic, and you'll find it a few scrolls down in your subscriber feed or if you Google Danica Kragic podcast. Again, big thank you for listening in, for your engagement and for your support. Take care and have an awesome day. Bye.